From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a concert by Exene Cervenka. She co-led X, the most important band to emerge from the Los Angeles hardcore punk scene of the 80s. But as you'll hear, she's a poet with roots in folk and country music. Also today, America's neo-colonial relationship with Micronesia, a group of 2,000 Pacific Islands that most Americans know nothing about. P.F. Kluge has been writing about Micronesia for 25 years. In fact, this American wrote the preamble to their constitution. And TV critic David Bianculli looks back on 13 years of Dallas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney begins a tour of the Gulf states on the eve of a U.S. withdrawal from southern Iraq. The commander of the 3rd Armored Division says his troops are ready to withdraw on Tuesday after clearing an Iraqi refugee camp. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
U.S. soldiers were bulldozing the defenses around the refugee camp today. It took 9 days to move over 8,000 Iraqi refugees from the southern Iraqi refugee camp of Safwan to a camp in northern Saudi Arabia. American troops remained in southern Iraq to provide protection for Iraqi refugees. The Saudi agreement to offer an alternative refuge meant that American forces could end their role as protectors and make room for 1,400 United Nations troops who will monitor the ceasefire. The UN commander had set a Wednesday deadline for all military personnel to withdraw from a demilitarized zone, the site of the Safwan refugee camp. The 3rd Armored Division is expected to move its headquarters to northern Kuwait. U.S. Secretary of State Dick Cheney is scheduled to visit the new headquarters tomorrow. In Riyadh, this is Deborah Amos.
The Yugoslav Army went on a nationwide alert today after new ethnic violence in the Republic of Croatia. The official Yugoslav news agency said that a soldier was killed by demonstrators in the Adriatic port city of Split. Local trade unions said as many as 50,000 people turned out to demonstrate against an army blockade of a Serbian village in Croatia. The people of Kijevo declared their village autonomous and wanted to become part of the Serbian Republic. Croatian President Franjo Tudjman appealed for calm and said that food and medicine are being sent to the troubled village. Ethnic violence is said to continue between other Serb and Croat villages in the region. President Bush returned to the White House this morning in good spirits after spending most of the weekend at the Bethesda Naval Hospital, where he was taken for treatment of an irregular heartbeat. The president's heart has been restored to a normal rate, but he'll stay on medication and wear a heart monitor indefinitely. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
After spending 2 nights in the hospital, President Bush returned to his normal work schedule today, meeting with former Soviet Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze, former Minnesota Senator Rudy Boschwitz, and the President of Cameroon. He told reporters he felt fine and that his heartbeat was normal. The decision was made early this morning not to use an electric shock procedure to restore the president's heart rate. Although his heart was still beating too quickly when he was discharged from the hospital, he was said to be responding to medication. Doctors said today they had not been pressured into releasing him prematurely. The president was asked on his return to the White House whether he had any doubts about Vice President Dan Quayle's ability to take charge if necessary. He said Quayle has his full support. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained just 3 points to close at 2,941.64. Declines edged advances. This is NPR News. The Space Shuttle Discovery made a safe landing in Florida this afternoon, ending an 8-day mission of research for the proposed Star Wars missile defense system. The space plane was diverted from its planned landing in California because of high winds. Discovery's 7 astronauts covered almost 3.5 million miles in the course of their mission. They encountered a number of technical problems during their research, including the failure of 2 information recorders. There's been a massive chlorine gas leak in Henderson, Nevada, immediately south of Las Vegas. At least 50 people have been hospitalized and thousands have been evacuated. John Stark of member station KNPR reports.
The chlorine gas leak occurred early this morning around 2 a.m. Pacific time at the Pioneer Chemical Plant, which manufactures chlorine for swimming pools. A 150-ton chlorine gas tank leaked. Reportedly, the leak has now been capped. At least 20 people are being treated for chlorine gas inhalation. Most are firefighters who were called in to deal with the emergency. Fire officials are currently monitoring the air in the plant with electronic sniffing devices that measure the presence of chemicals. All roads leading into Henderson, Nevada have been closed. Schools throughout Henderson are also closed. The chlorine gas cloud is hanging over Henderson. There's little air movement, but winds are expected to pick up later today and move the chlorine gas cloud in a northwesterly direction, possibly toward Las Vegas. For National Public Radio, this is John Stark in Las Vegas.
Demonstrations have begun again in the section of Washington, D.C. that was shaken by violence last night. It wasn't clear how much activity was taking place in the Mount Pleasant area where violence broke out yesterday after a man was shot while being arrested. The neighborhood is largely Hispanic, and Hispanic leaders have charged that city police have been insensitive and discriminatory. Mayor Sharon Pratt Dixon met this afternoon with Hispanic leaders and pledged to look into problems of job opportunities, discrimination, and housing. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We have a concert for you today featuring Exene Cervenka. She used to co-lead the band X with John Doe. X was the most literary and the most successful of the bands that emerged from the Los Angeles hardcore punk scene of the 80s. Their roots were in folk, blues, and country, as well as rock and roll. Exene and John Doe met at a writer's workshop. They married in the early 80s, but at the end of the decade they separated and broke up the band. Now they each have solo careers, although they've recently started working together again. Exene's new album, Running Sacred, is her second solo album. Two of the musicians featured on the album are accompanying her today, Duke McVinney and Tony Gilkison. Gilkison used to be a member of X, and he produced both of Exene's records. Here's Exene Cervenka to introduce the first song.
Boy and His Sister was a song that Tony and I wrote the music to. My husband's name is Viggo Mortensen. He was the writer of the words. He's a really good poet. And it's a story, and it has a lot of different meanings. And I'm not sure anyone knows what it's really about. A miniature priest of passive purity, they saved his tears in the top right-hand drawer after spanking him for crying. His sister watched, she knew how not to cry. He was very well liked by very, very few, but he did his best in school. You never saw the like. Never a nuisance, this little boy even prayed. So did his sister. So did his sister. Was well liked by the boys. She did her best, which was good enough to please, and grew tall and so pretty. By the day he was small for his age, he dreamed of holding hands. By now he knew how not to cry at all. You never saw the light. Little boy even prayed. So did his sister. So did his sister. He knew a lot about insects for his age, and trees and the weather in general. It was something to do. His sister got an abortion. I think he lives in a cabin he built in the swamp outside town. Nobody goes there, they don't care if he's there. You never saw the like. Never a nuisance, this little boy even prayed. So did his sister. So did his sister. Sister worked in the market for a while. She got caught ripping off her petty cash, I heard, and she left town to be a dancer on the stage. He's invisible in the swamp. You see smoke from his fires. That's all, that's all. You never saw the light. Never a nuisance. This little boy, he even prayed. So did his sister. So did his sister.
Okay, sounding great.
Ooh.
And with us is Exene Cervenka, who's singing, and joining her on guitar, we have Tony Gilkison and Duke McPhinney.
Mm-hmm.
Exene, do you think that being a solo performer now is bringing out different parts of your singing or your writing than with X?
Yeah, what, X was a democracy, and that's kind of hard.
Got fed up with democracy.
No, I'm not fed up with democracy. It's just it gets hard because everyone's feelings have to be taken into account. And when you're writing a song, there may be certain things that people don't want to play. And I think this way it's good. People know what you're like as an individual, and they can decide whether they want to join up with you or not.
What do you think is different about your singing and your songs as a solo performer?
Everything. They're completely different. I didn't write the music in X. John Doe did. I write the music for most of these songs. I think I said that Tony wrote most of the music for that. I wrote a little. It makes you completely autonomous. It makes you independent, and it makes you kind of freeze you up, you know, so that you can do anything you want, and it's just really great to do it that way.
Let me ask you to do another song for us.
Okay. I think we're doing Missing Nature now.
1, 2, 3, 4.
It doesn't matter where I live. It's a joyous excursion, new town, small town. We are right side up. Everyone else is upside down. Panhandling the cabinets. I could eat the granite and the square green farmland, every tree in sight. I wanna lay my head on Mount St. Helens for the night. Stop the world, I wanna get back on, even if it's almost gone. Stop the world, I wanna get back on. Stop the world, I wanna get back on. Wouldn't it be fun to stop the world and watch all the people fall off? And the polka dot liquor stores in the Carolinas, all of the gardens, all the green tomatoes, the nicely made wind and the well-designed heat, old flat homesteads and the haunted cities we can count. Oh, old barns. Stop the world, I wanna get back on, even if
It's almost gone. Stop the world. I want to get back on. Stop the world. I want to get back on. Stop the world. I want to get back on. Even if it's almost gone. Stop the world. I want to get back on. Stop the world. I want to get back on.
That's great. That's Exene Cervenka singing, and she wrote the song. And
this one I wrote, yes.
Exene, you started off as a poet before you started to write music or sing. Mm. Can you tell us a little bit about that transition between writing poetry and becoming a performer?
I was afraid John was going to steal all my words if I didn't sing them.
Well, he John Doe wanted to set your words to music?
Yeah, and then I just thought, well, I think I'll do this too, because I thought it was a really good time for people to start bands. It was like 76. Actually, it was more like 77 by that point, but what's the difference? Anyway, I just wanted to do what other people were doing, which was leading this exciting life and being an artist and not just being a one-dimensional kind of sitting in my room writing Diary of a Lost Girl. So that's what we did.
Were you comfortable being on stage and singing at first?
I've never been comfortable being on stage and singing in front of people. I think it's really difficult, and I don't think that means that one doesn't like it or that you don't, that it isn't your destiny or something to do it. It just means that it's hard.
Did you think that you could sing before you started singing in front of audiences? Had you sung a lot in your room or with friends? Were you ever in a band?
Can't you tell? No, I wasn't, and I didn't care what it sounded like. I just thought it was really neat to be able to have something to say and to be able to say it really loud.
And it was a period, too, that really wasn't about technique. So,
it was about not having any technique, which you can get away with for a while. Everyone should be allowed to do that for a while.
When was the period when you felt like...
Immediately.
Really?
Are you going to say when I started to have to learn something?
Well, when you felt that you wanted to learn more technique.
Yeah, immediately, as soon as I realized I didn't know anything.
So what did you do?
I started taking voice lessons, and I've been taking them since 1980. And I also, finally learned music to an extent that you never stop, I guess, learning. But, and it was really funny, too, because in the early days of X, you'd read these reviews that were like New York Times and all these like kind of really nice magazines, Rolling Stone. And they'd be saying what our harmonies were if they were like fifths or what kind of scales and all these kind of things. And then sometimes interviewers would ask me about, in technical terms, like why I would sing this certain style. And I of course, was very proud of the fact that I had no idea what they were talking about because it seemed more genuine.
My guess is Exene Cervenka, and the songs that she sung so far are from her new album, Running Sacred. And two of the performers in her band are with us as well, Tony Gilkison and Duke McVinney, and they're both featured on guitar in our concert today. Short break, and then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Featuring a concert on Fresh Air today with Exene Cervenka, who has a new album called Running Sacred. And with her on guitars today, we have Tony Gilkison and Duke McVinney. And I should mention here that Tony Gilkison today is playing a Gibson guitar that has been very graciously loaned to us by Vintage Instruments of Philadelphia. I want to ask you a few things about your background. Where did you grow up? I know when you started performing music, you were living in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. but where did you come there from?
I lived in Illinois when I was a kid, growing up in a rural area, and then I lived in Florida for a while, various cities. I came directly from Tallahassee, which is a really good place to go if you really need inspiration, to go to a city, and, you know, it's like a... It just, for me, at that time, late 70s, it was a very difficult place to be, and so it got me motivated to get out of there and go someplace. I'd never lived in a big city before, you know, like L.A., so...
So you still think of yourself as a rural person?
I think of myself as a rural person who's learned to put on the city kind of armor to live in a city, but I don't think I'm... I don't know. I try not to analyze what I am too much.
What did your parents do for a living?
My father was a carpenter, and my mom was a mom.
Excuse me for asking what I'm sure you'll think of as a really stupid question, but Exene Cervenka is your birth name?
My last name is Cervenka. My real name is Christine, which is Christ is X. I just changed it like Xmas, you know, to Exene.
Oh, okay. Because I had to first assume that was a name that you took since everybody was taking names at the time.
Yeah, no, see, that was way before all that music stuff. I was 18 when I did that. It was just a thing to do. But that's my real last name.
So what motivated the change?
What motivated the change? I guess what motivates everything I do is just I wanted everything to be mine, to be what I decided things should be. The name I decided I should have, the kind of life I decide I want to have, and people, you know, the people I want to be with. It's just, I don't know, I just didn't like that name, I guess, too. I just wanted to be me.
Can I ask you to do one more song? Could you do Curtains?
I think we could.
To the agency of mercy, please admit one. Time is tomorrow, where it's never too late, and when it's never too late, it's never too early. Safe sex with a dangerous man, urges deepened by his talent. You know that kind of inspiration is awfully hard to come by. Ice cold vision, rabid rambling, smoky fever, jazz without in the tongue. So loose, it wants to drop out of her head, her head, her head. It comes again in easiness and sleaziness, and you know the rest. How a dime's worth of desire, spend your whole life overnight. The faces of the deep swim silently lit up by underwater fire. And the men along the road are electric poles leaned over from snow and age now. Her flowers are up, the first of spring. Curtains blown in the blue wind, clothesline empty, hamper full, but there's nothing she can do. Do. He said he'd make her life complete. He didn't say she'd be finished when he went away. She thought she wanted to die, but she was uncertain. She didn't call it the facts of life. She didn't call it curtains.
have mercy. Oh, please admit one.
That's Curtains, written and sung by Exene Cervenka. I have to ask you about Dances with Wolves.
Mm-hmm.
It's a line in one of your poems.
Yeah.
And when, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting his name, but when the person who wrote the screenplay...
Michael Blake.
Right, accepted his Academy Award, he thanked you.
Yeah, he thanked me and Doug Knott and Jocelyn Heaney, two other writers. They all happen to be writers that he knows, but that he does respect. It wasn't because he knows us that he mentioned us. I've known him a while, and when he was writing the book, we were very close, and he was kind of one of those down-and-out guys staying at my house and all that. And I think it's great that he recognizes people, and that usually, to me, the people you're most influenced by and that help you the most in your art happen to be people you know. I mean, there's books that influence you and other musicians or singers you'll never meet that influence you, but my most important influences are people I know.
Who wrote the line Dances with Wolves first, you or he?
With the name?
Yeah.
Oh, he did.
So you borrowed it from him for...
Well, it isn't in a poem. You know what it was on my first record, Old Wives' Tales. I have the poem Gravel about the two people that go and blow up Mount Rushmore. And I put down she stands with a fist and he dances with wolves. And I didn't do it because of the movie. I did it because... again, it's like him thanking me. It was just to stick something in there so when he got the record, he'd see it, and it would be kind of a nice thing to do. And I could figure that those people could have been the people in the movie or their descendants blowing up Mount Rushmore. So I made a little connection.
And one last thing. How has being a mother changed your life?
Well, it's changed it completely. And I don't know what it would be like without having a son to take care of and be with. I don't see it coming out in my art too much as far as what I write about, but I think it makes you expand as a person where you reach these heights and depths that you didn't know you had of selfishness or love or patience or, you know, you're just on the verge of complete anger and you know, you don't know what you're going to do. And I guess that teaches you something about yourself, and anything that teaches you about yourself is good for your art. So in that way, I'm sure it's helped or changed things.
I want to thank you a lot.
Thank you
talking
very
with
much.
Us and for performing. Thank mm-hmm. you very much. And my guest has been singer and songwriter Exene Cervenka. She has a new album called Running Sacred. And two of the performers on that record have been with us today, both playing guitar, Tony Gilkison and Duke McVinnie. And I want to thank Vintage Instruments for loaning us the Gibson guitar that Tony Gilkison has playing today. And Tony and Duke, thanks a lot. You all sounded really great.
Yes, thank you for playing these songs
thanks
with
very,
me
very
today.
Much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Okay.
I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And would you like to play us out?
The inflatable teardrop finally fell, like the blood-red drops of a bad spell. And when it fell, broke, and lots of water come out. That was some storm. Just fell and fell and fell.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Micronesia isn't the South Pacific, because the islands of Micronesia are north of the equator. Yet Micronesia is sometimes thought of as the kind of tropical paradise Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote songs about. But there's trouble in paradise. Coming up, P.F. Kluge on America's neocolonial relationship with Micronesia. He's been writing about these islands for 25 years, and even though he's an American, he wrote part of the Micronesian Constitution. And after 13 years, the TV show Dallas called it quits last week. TV critic David Bianculli looks back on the show's many twists and turns. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush is back at the White House after doctors agreed that his heartbeat could be stabilized with medication. Mr. Bush resumed his normal schedule this morning and said that he did not anticipate changes in his lifestyle or working pace. Over the weekend, the president suffered an irregular heartbeat while jogging, and he was hospitalized at Bethesda Naval Hospital. Doctors say that once Mr. Bush's medication is properly adjusted, he may resume exercising. In Bangladesh, officials say about 126,000 people have died so far from last week's cyclone, and there are still problems in getting supplies to thousands of stranded people. The country is short of helicopters to deliver food, clothing, and medicine to some of the more isolated islands along the southeastern coast. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling is in the capital and says that there has been concern that the U.S. is not sending enough money to help survivors.
Initially, when people here heard that the United States was promising $2 million to the relief effort, there was a lot of distress, and people said, look how much money people like the U.S. are spending on the Kurds. Well, this crisis is even more serious than that. But the U.S. and other governments are now saying the initial figures were just the very beginning, what they were rushing here overnight. U.S. Embassy officials told me today that they are planning a much vaster relief effort. They won't say how vast. They say they'll announce that soon. And they expect other countries, especially from Europe, to chip in generously, too.
NPR's Daniel Zwerdling in Bangladesh. In Yugoslavia, armed forces are on alert after a violent attack on a naval base in the Croatian port city of Split. Pierre Vickery reports that one soldier was killed and several demonstrators were injured when thousands of people tried to storm a military headquarters.
The Croatian president, Dr. Franjo Tudjman, issued an urgent appeal for calm after a huge crowd attempted to storm the naval headquarters in Split. Demonstrators attacked an armored personnel carrier and, after disarming it, took it away in triumph. Shots were fired during the protest, killing a 19-year-old conscript. The demonstrators were protesting the fact that the army had not allowed Croatian villages in Serbian-controlled regions to receive medical supplies. Relations between the army and the Republic of Croatia have been deteriorating for some time, and following the Split attack, military leaders placed the armed forces on full battle alert. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 3 points to close at 2,941.64 on volume of only 128 million shares. This is NPR News. U.S. military officials plan to take up to 200,000 Iraqi refugees home this week from camps on the Turkish border. The convoy will include dozens of rented Iraqi trucks along with helicopters to carry the refugees. Between 450,000 and 800,000 Kurds fled to the mountains in March in order to escape an Iraqi government crackdown. About 1.5 million people fled to the Iranian border. Those people being moved this week may go back to their homes or stay in allied camps. The Space Shuttle Discovery completed its mission this afternoon with an unscheduled landing in Florida. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
shuttle was scheduled to land today at Edwards Air Force Base in California, but high winds kicked up just before the shuttle was to re-enter the atmosphere to begin its descent. Forecasters predicted that the winds may be undependable tomorrow also, so managers decided to shoot for the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, where conditions were perfect. Discovery touched down just before 3 o'clock Eastern Time. This is only the seventh time out of 40 shuttle missions where the orbiter has landed in Florida, the last coming last November when bad weather forced Atlantis to choose Kennedy. Today's landing completes 8 days and 7 hours worth of Star Wars anti-missile defense testing. The next shuttle mission is scheduled for liftoff in about 2 weeks. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Secretary of State James Baker heads back to the Middle East later this week in another effort to arrange a Middle Eastern peace conference. It will be Baker's fourth trip since the end of the Persian Gulf War to try to convene an Arab-Israeli peace conference. Baker returned from his last trip just over 1 week ago, having made no apparent progress. In trading today in New York, the dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. Gold prices moved up. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In 1967, the Peace Corps ran a recruiting ad that proclaimed, "The Peace Corps is going to paradise." Paradise turned out to be Micronesia. My guest P.F. Kluge was one of the Peace Corps volunteers sent there, a pretty obscure paradise. Like most Americans, Kluge knew nothing about these 2,000 islands scattered in the Western Pacific, even though they were ruled by America. We captured them from the Japanese in World War II. Now this tropical paradise has hamburgers, jukeboxes, and resort hotels. It may soon have military bases. Kluge has returned to these islands many times over the past 25 years. His new book is called The Edge of Paradise, America in Micronesia. Kluge is a former correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. His novel, Eddie and the Cruisers, was adapted into a film. Kluge himself is an interesting footnote in American colonial history. While he was with the Peace Corps, he helped draft the Micronesian Statement of Intent, their equivalent of the Declaration of Independence. He later was one of the directors of the Micronesian Constitutional Convention, and he wrote the preamble to their constitution.
They were among the last of about a dozen post-World War II UN trust territories. They were looking at their future. There were a bunch of politicians freshly returned from school in the States who were beginning to negotiate the future of the islands with the United States. It was a small but very interesting game which I became a part of.
What do you remember writing? What are some of the lines from the Statement of Intent or the preamble to the Constitution that really stick in your mind?
Oh, good Lord, I could find them on T-shirts and in classrooms all over Micronesia. The one that's my favorite and is to the effect that the seas do not divide the islands, they bring the islands together. It was very eloquent and naive stuff, and I'm not quite sure how true it was, but it sounded good at the time.
You know, there's something very odd, I think you have to agree, about having an American write the messages about how Micronesians won't stand for colonialism.
That was among the many ironies of the place, but I had no conflict. I sensed no conflict there because I thought it was in the interest of the United States and of Micronesia that they make the best possible arrangement between basically a superpower and a flotilla of Lilliputs. And so if I was there helping the Lilliputs, that was all right with me, and I think all right with them.
Well, didn't you feel somewhat in between since you were an American? I mean, you are an American.
Yes, I'm an American, and I felt no conflict at all. I felt America had shown many faces in Micronesia, military faces, cynical faces, sometimes altruistic faces. And I thought that I could do good, really, by representing America on the Micronesian side. I cast myself very romantically in a sort of Lowell Thomas Edgar Snow kind of role.
What does it say about the status of Micronesians at the time that they were relying on you to help write their Declaration of Independence and their Constitution?
Well, I think in terms of dealing with each other, they were just fine, or at least not bad. But they were dealing, after all, with the United States. And when their appeal was couched towards the Americans, when it was aimed in their direction, when they were trying to get attention, then I think it benefited them to have an American writer on their side.
Now, I think very few Americans are really familiar with the islands of Micronesia. Give us your basic introductory rap when someone says to you, but what is Micronesia?
Oh, I've done it. Oh, yes, yes. I have this memorized. It's a group of islands, 2,000 islands, west of Hawaii, south of Japan, all of them north of the equator. Therefore, we never say South Pacific in connection with Micronesia. 2,000 islands captured by the U.S. in World War II, previously administered by Japan, by Germany, by Spain. 2,000 islands with an aggregate land mass half the size of Rhode Island, scattered over an area of ocean the size of the continental United States. 9 mutually unintelligible local languages, smatterings depending on the age of the speaker, of German, although most of the German speakers are dead now, Japanese, and English. Slight resources, fishing, copra, which that is dried coconut meat, which is pretty much gone these days, and increasingly in recent years, tourism. A continuing military interest on the part of the United States, which did not want to have to recapture the same islands it captured in World War II. That basically is my preliminary Micronesia rap. Then I get poetic and I talk about small, funky, fallen, lovely, endearing places. The conjunction of heat and discomfort with sometimes shocking beauty. The sense that you're in a paradise, but it's a very fallen paradise. The roof leaks. The you drive, you rent may not have all frills, like, say, a spare tire and a handbrake. It's a sort of place that is definitely one step beyond Hawaii. It's not, there's no Aloha spirit, no Waikiki caliber tourism there. It's definitely for the adventurous.
Of the 2,000 islands,
yes.
How many of them are actually inhabited?
Well, only about 100, but many of them, when you give that figure, you say 2,000 islands, and wow, only 100 or 200 of them inhabited. People sitting in the U.S. think, well, gee whiz, 1,800 islands that I could live my fantasy life on, uninhabited. And in fact, all those islands, or almost all of those islands, are regularly visited. It's a matter of having 20 islands inside a lagoon, and maybe only 3 have settlements on them. The other 17, though, are definitely owned by someone. They're not just sitting there waiting for an American to wash up on them.
My guest is P.F. Kluge, and he's written a new book called The Edge of Paradise, America in Micronesia. And he's been going to Micronesia since he first went there in 1967 as part of the Peace Corps. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. P.F. Kluge is my guest, and his new book is about America in Micronesia. It's called The Edge of Paradise. When you got to Micronesia in 1967 with the Peace Corps, they were a U.S. trust territory.
Yes.
What's the relationship now of the United States to Micronesia?
Out of the old trust territory, 4 different entities have emerged. What happened is that when the negotiations about the political future started with the U.S., there were divisions among the Micronesians themselves. Micronesian was always sort of an abstract kind of umbrella term, like South American. It was very, it didn't bind people. It wasn't really a major source of identification. It wasn't what they would really call themselves. So there were divisions within Micronesia, basically along lines of ethnicity, about 6 different ethnic groups, and along lines of money, the have districts and the have-not districts. In general, the have districts were the ones where there was an active U.S. military interest or presence or an active tourism. So there's the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas, the Republic of the Marshall Islands, the Republic of Palau, and then something called the Federated States of Micronesia, a unit which includes Yap, Ponape, Truk, and Kusai.
And what's the political relationship with the United States and Micronesia?
Basically, the United States handles defense and foreign affairs, and the locals handle local government.
So do we still have a colonial relationship with them?
I think probably the word would be neo-colonial, and there are some people who would give you an argument on that. The United States has always liked not to think of itself as a colonial power. We like to say that we don't fight wars to acquire territory. So we're sort of an uncola of colonial powers. And that's fair enough, but what I've discovered over 25 years of obsession with Micronesia is that whether we go there as missionaries or as Peace Corps volunteers or as Budweiser distributors or as military reconnaissance team, we have an impact on the place. And the subversive, inadvertent effects of the American presence are more profound than anything we do intentionally. It's the jukeboxes, the cold beer, the Boston Whalers, the video cassettes. Those are the overwhelming weapons, and they are not intentionally colonial or neo-colonial weapons, but they are more than most cultures can withstand.
What does America want with Micronesia? We acquired these islands after World War II. Japan had them before.
Yes.
What do we want with them?
I think our motives have always been mixed and tangled. Altruistically, we want them to do well. We want there to be education and health care and reasonable economic development. We, from a military point of view, want the right to use the islands if we need them. And we also want what's called the strategic right of denial, the knowledge that no other military power will be in the islands. So it's always been one or the other. We wanted them to come along, to have a self-government, to at least flirt with the idea of quasi-independence. On the other hand, we didn't want any unpleasantness out there again.
So you say we want them if we need them. Does that mean if we need them for military bases?
Yes.
Are there any military bases there now?
Well, there is the Kwajalein Missile Test Site Range in the Marshall Islands, and there are options on military bases in the Marianas. And if we ever, the agreement with Palau hasn't been finalized yet, but if we ever cut a deal with the Republic of Palau, there too we will have military options.
If we had trouble keeping our military bases in the Philippines, would Micronesia be a next best place to look, do you think, for the American military?
I don't think there is a best place for the facilities of the size that we have at Subic Bay and Clark Field in the Philippines. They are massive. They employ thousands of people. It would be a disaster, I think, if we moved any fraction of those bases to Micronesia. The islands are small. There isn't a local labor pool. You'd have to bring in labor from elsewhere. That, I think, would be the destruction of paradise.
Might it happen anyways?
Yes. Yes. It's one of the things that I worry about.
When you joined the Peace Corps in 67, the Peace Corps pitch was, the Peace Corps is going to paradise.
Yes.
And the title of your book is The Edge of Paradise. Has paradise now become a marketing idea, you know, a way of advertising the islands?
I think it has. All of us who live or have lived in Micronesia and use the word paradise now lace it with a certain amount of irony. But there is still that dream that won't die, that people can come to islands, tropical islands, small places, contain their problems, know the place, and live a more carefree and yet more thoughtful life than they can elsewhere. That dream doesn't die, and there are people everywhere I come across who are still contemplating maybe going to an island. And there are elements of paradise in Micronesia. There are black sand beaches, there are volcanoes, there are jungle waterfalls and rainforests. I revel in those things. But when you've been around there a while, you also know there are flat tires, there are mosquito coils, there's mediocre cooking, there's a certain sullenness and boredom which attaches itself to island life, a sort of familiarity that often grows into contempt, and a certain sense of compromise and being left out. So, yes, there are elements of paradise which won't die. There is also an underside of it. And it's the mixture of the two and the tension between the two that I find very, very attractive and interesting. If it were a pure paradise, I don't think it would be as much fun.
When the Micronesian tourist industry markets paradise, what are they referring to and how do they market it?
Well, most of the tourists, you must realize, who come to Micronesia come from Japan. And they come mainly to one district, the Northern Marianas. And it is basically their Florida. They bake on the beaches. They go around to the various war monuments, the caves, the cliffs, the beaches on which the previous generation of Japanese died. And they do a lot of shopping. They go around to duty-free shops, and that pretty much is the nature of Japanese tourism in the Marianas. Now, the other districts are harder to get to and attract a more eccentric kind of tourist. There are, for instance, Micronesia is a mecca for skin divers. There are great coral reefs in Palau, among the best in the world. And then I guess you have people, tourists who come to Micronesia just for romantic reasons or because the sound of the names of the islands is interesting. Helen Reef, Kapinga, Morangay, Ponape. There are still those sort of eccentric literary adventurers who come along. But what you're not seeing in Micronesia and may never see because it stops at Hawaii is the sort of mass meet you with a lay at the airport type tourism and then put you in the shuttle bus. They're not set up for that, and I frankly hope they never will be.
You've written that you've been told by editors for years that these islands were too small, too far away for people to really care about, and that you should pick a better subject. This must be very frustrating for you to be so interested in Micronesia, a part of the world that most Americans don't even know about, let alone care about.
I knew it from the moment I came home from the Peace Corps, and I had, as all Peace Corps volunteers do, that 400-slide show that was going to charm my relatives. And the first question and last question is, what do they eat over there? I bet they don't eat like this. And that was the end of the show and the end of their interest. And yeah, it's bothered me. I mean, I realize you can't really get there from here. It wasn't a big subject. And yet it was one that engrossed me extraordinarily and kept me coming back to it. I realized it didn't have the book contracts, the grants. There's no chair in Micronesian studies anywhere. It was really an obscure topic that I'd impaled myself on, but I did want to see how the game continued to play out between America and Micronesia, and I guess I will keep going back despite my, I must admit, increasing pessimism about the outcome of it all. The fact that it's I think, going in the wrong direction doesn't mean that I love it less.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
My guest has been P.F. Kluge. His new book is called The Edge of Paradise, America in Micronesia. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. We'll have an update on the health of President Bush after his speeded-up heart rate over the weekend. His doctors expect him to be back to a normal schedule next week, including jogging. I'll talk with NPR's Dan Swerdling in Dhaka, Bangladesh, about the relief efforts there after last week's cyclone. There are now estimates of up to 250,000 dead. Also, Robert Siegel has a conversation with Vytautas Landsbergis, the president of Lithuania. He's here in Washington visiting and asking for official recognition and some trade help. Also, some say the civil war has already started in Yugoslavia. Clashes today between the army and Croatians in the Adriatic town of Split.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last week, CBS presented what it says is the final episode of Dallas. TV critic David Bianculli looks back on its 13-year run.
It's the last minute of the last episode of Dallas. Larry Hagman as J.R. Ewing has spent most of the previous 2 hours escorted through Fantasyland by guest star Joel Grey. Grey's character is like the angel who guided Jimmy Stewart through It's a Wonderful Life, showing what life would have been like for his friends and family if he'd never been born. Except that Grey is no angel. He's a little devil. And after a still drunken J.R. wakes up from his 2-hour dream, still clutching his gun and thinking of suicide, the devil pops up again and eggs him on.
Oh my God, what a nightmare. I still got nobody. Nobody cares.
You thought it was a dream?
Go on. Pull that trigger.
This is when Patrick Duffy, as Bobby, walks upstairs to the hallway outside JR's closed bedroom door, then runs to open the door after hearing an alarming sound. He opens the door, looks in, and says, "Well, here, for the record, are the last moments of Dallas."
Do it!
Now, don't feel like you're being cheated on radio just because you can't see what Bobby was looking at when he opened that door. Nobody watching on TV saw it either. Leonard Katzman, who wrote and directed the final episode, ended it with a freeze frame of Bobby's face. For all we know, he could have been looking at his ex-wife Pam, stepping out of the shower and telling him that the entire 13 years of Dallas had been one bad dream. But no, that would have been too clever. Instead, Dallas managed to end with a primetime paradox. It went out with a bang and a whimper. There was a time, even though it was 11 long years ago, that Dallas and the Who Shot J.R. mystery was the biggest thing on television, much bigger even than Who Killed Laura Palmer. The episode of Dallas in which J.R.'s assailant was revealed is still the second most popular series episode in TV history, topped only by the final episode of MASH. But now, as the non-ending to all those years of Dallas, the question isn't who shot J.R., it's who shot J.R.? Or, more precisely, who cares? The actors who stuck around or returned for the dream sequence finale got to have fun by playing against type. But without Victoria Principal as Pam, Dallas was missing a crucial character whose absence could not be overlooked. And the cliffhanger finale, which obviously leaves the door open for a telemovie sequel, was inexcusable. Hagman, the show's star and co-executive producer, said recently that he'd entertain the idea of a Dallas reunion telemovie only if it were conceived as a parody. What he doesn't realize is that Dallas became a parody of itself years ago, when Bobby's death was erased away as a season-long dream. Like J.R., Dallas was shot a long time ago.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Voblitis, Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Bob Alls. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, John Kander of the songwriting team Kander and Ebb. Their best-known show is Cabaret. One of their best-known songs is New York, New York. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.